Chapter 7. The Nazification of Germany, 1933-1934. The theory which Hitler had evolved in his vagabond days in Vienna, and never forgotten, that the way to power for a revolutionary movement was to ally itself with some of the powerful institutions in the state, had now worked out in practice pretty much as he had calculated. The president, backed by the army and the conservatives, had made him chancellor. His political power, though great, was, however, not complete. It was shared with these three sources of authority, which had put him into office and which were outside, and to some extent, distrustful of the National Socialist movement. Hitler's immediate task, therefore, was to quickly eliminate them from the driver's seat, make his party the exclusive master of the state, and then, with the power of an authoritarian government and its police, carry out the Nazi revolution. He had been in office scarcely 24 hours when he made his first decisive move, springing a trap on his gullible conservative captors and setting in motion a chain of events which he either originated or controlled and which at the end of 6 months would bring the complete Nazification of Germany and his own elevation to dictator of the Reich, unified and defederalized for the first time in German history. 5 hours after being sworn in, at 5 p.m. on January 30, 1933, Hitler held his first cabinet meeting. The minutes of the session, which turned up at Nuremberg among the hundreds of tons of captured secret documents, reveal how quickly and adroitly Hitler, aided by the crafty Göring, began to take his conservative colleagues for a ride. This cabinet meeting, of course, was private, and like most of the other conferences, many of them taking place in the strictest secrecy, held by Hitler and his political and military aides during the Third Reich. Its proceedings and decisions were not accessible to the public until the captured German documents were first perused during the Nuremberg trial. A great many of these highly confidential discussions and the decisions emanating from them, all regarded as state secrets, will henceforth be chronicled in this book, which, from here to the end, largely rests on the documents which recorded them at the time. No other history of a nation over a specific epoch has been so fully documented, I believe, as that of the Third Reich, and to have left out reference to the documents, it seemed to the author, would have greatly weakened whatever value this book may have as an authentic historical record. Hindenburg had named Hitler to head not only a presidential cabinet, but one based on a majority in the Reichstag. However, the Nazis and the Nationalists, the only two parties represented in the government, had only 247 seats out of 583 in Parliament, and thus lacked a majority. To attain it, they needed the backing of the Centre Party with its 70 seats. In the very first hours of the new government, Hitler had dispatched Göring to talk with the centrist leaders, and now he reported to the cabinet that the Centre was demanding certain concessions. Göring therefore proposed that the Reichstag be dissolved and new elections held, and Hitler agreed. Hugenberg, a man of wooden mind for all his success in business, objected to taking the center into the government, but on the other hand, opposed new elections, well knowing that the Nazis, with the resources of the state behind them, might win an absolute majority at the polls and thus be in a position to dispense with his own services and those of his conservative friends. He proposed simply suppressing the Communist Party. With its 100 seats eliminated, the Nazis and the Nationalists would have a majority. But Hitler would not go so far at the moment, and it was finally agreed that the Chancellor himself would confer with the Centre Party leaders on the following morning, and that if the talks were fruitless, the cabinet would then ask for new elections. Hitler easily made them fruitless. At his request, the Centre leader, Monsignor Kass, submitted as a basis for discussion a list of questions which added up to a demand that Hitler promised to govern constitutionally. But Hitler, tricking both Kass and his cabinet members, reported to the latter that the center had made impossible demands and that there was no chance of agreement. He therefore proposed that the president be asked to dissolve the Reichstag and call new elections. Hugenberg and Papen were trapped, but after a solemn assurance from the Nazi leader that the cabinet would remain unchanged however the elections turned out, they agreed to go along with him. New elections were set for March 5th. For the first time, in the last relatively free election Germany was to have, the Nazi Party now could employ all the vast resources of the government to win votes. Goebbels was jubilant. "Now it will be easy," he wrote in his diary on February 3rd, "to carry on the fight, for we can call on all the resources of the state. Radio and press are at our disposal. We shall stage a masterpiece of propaganda. At this time, naturally, there is no lack of money. The big businessmen, pleased with the new government that was going to put the organized workers in their place and leave management to run its businesses as it wished, were asked to cough up. This they agreed to do at a meeting on February 20th at Goering's Reichstag President's Palace, at which Dr. Schacht acted as host, and Goering and Hitler laid down the line to a couple of dozen of Germany's leading magnates, including Krupp von Bohlen, who had become an enthusiastic Nazi overnight, Bosch and Schnitzler of IG Farben, and Fugler, head of the United Steelworks. The record of this secret meeting has been preserved. Hitler began a long speech with a sop to the industrialists. "Private enterprise," he said, "cannot be maintained in the age of democracy. It is conceivable only if the people have a sound idea of authority and personality. All the worldly goods we possess we owe to the struggle of the chosen. We must not forget that all the benefits of culture must be introduced more or less with an iron fist." He promised the businessmen that he would eliminate the Marxists and restore the Wehrmacht. The latter was of special interest to such industries as Krupp, United Steel, and IG Farben, which stood to gain the most from rearmament. "Now we stand before the last election," Hitler concluded, and he promised his listeners that, regardless of the outcome, there will be no retreat. If he did not win, he would stay in power by other means, with other weapons. Goering, talking more to the immediate point, stressed the necessity of financial sacrifices, which surely would be much easier for industry to bear if it realized that the election of March 5th will surely be the last one for the next 10 years, probably even for the next 100 years. All this was made clear enough to the assembled industrialists, and they responded with enthusiasm to the promise of the end of the infernal elections, of democracy and disarmament. Krupp, the munitions king, who, according to Thyssen, had urged Hindenburg on January 29th not to appoint Hitler, jumped up and expressed to the chancellor the gratitude of the businessmen for having given us such a clear picture. Dr. Schacht then passed the hat. "I collected 3 million marks, he recalled at Nuremberg. On January 31st, 1933, the day after Hitler was named chancellor, Goebbels wrote in his diary, "In a conference with the Führer, we lay down the line for the fight against the Red Terror. For the moment, we shall abstain from direct countermeasures. The Bolshevik attempt at revolution must first burst into flame. At the proper moment, we shall strike." Despite increasing provocation by the Nazi authorities, there was no sign of a revolution, communist or socialist, bursting into flames as the electoral campaign got underway. By the beginning of February, the Hitler government had banned all communist meetings and shut down the communist press. Social Democrat rallies were either forbidden or broken up by the SA rowdies, and the leading socialist newspapers were continually suspended. Even the Catholic Center Party did not escape the Nazi terror. Stegerwald, the leader of the Catholic trade unions, was beaten by brown shirts when he attempted to address a meeting, and Brüning was obliged to seek police protection at another rally, after SA troopers had wounded a number of his followers. Altogether, 51 anti-Nazis were listed as murdered during the electoral campaign, and the Nazis claimed that 18 of their own number had been done to death. Goering's key position as Minister of the Interior of Prussia now began to be noticed. Ignoring the restraining hand of Papen, who as Premier of Prussia was supposedly above him, Goering removed hundreds of Republican officials and replaced them with Nazis, mostly SA and SS officers. He ordered the police to avoid, at all costs, hostility to the SA, the SS, and the Stahlhelm, but on the other hand, to show no mercy to those who were hostile to the state. He urged the police to make use of firearms and warned that those who didn't would be punished. This was an outright call for the shooting down of all who opposed Hitler by the police of a state, Prussia, which controlled 2/3 of Germany. Just to make sure that the job would be ruthlessly done, Goering on February 22nd established an auxiliary police force of 50,000 men, of whom 40,000 were drawn from the ranks of the SA and the SS, and the rest from the Stahlhelm. Police power in Prussia was thus largely carried out by Nazi thugs. It was a rash German who appealed to such a police for protection against the Nazi terrorists. And yet, despite all the terror, the Bolshevik Revolution, which Goebbels, Hitler, and Goering were looking for, failed to burst into flames. If it could not be provoked, Might it not have to be invented? On February 24th, Goering's police raided the Karl Liebknecht House, the communist headquarters in Berlin. It had been abandoned some weeks before by the communist leaders, a number of whom had already gone underground or quietly slipped off to Russia. But piles of propaganda pamphlets had been left in the cellar, and these were enough to enable Goering to announce in an official communique that the seized documents proved that the communists were about to launch the revolution. The reaction of the public and even some of the conservatives in the government was one of skepticism. It was obvious that something more sensational must be found to stampede the public before the election took place on March 5th. The Reichstag Fire. On the evening of February 27th, four of the most powerful men in Germany were gathered at two separate dinners in Berlin. In the exclusive Herrenklub in the Vossstrasse, Vice-Chancellor von Papen was entertaining President von Hindenburg. Out at Goebbels's home, Chancellor Hitler had arrived to dine en famille. According to Goebbels, they were relaxing, playing music on the gramophone and telling stories. Suddenly, he recounted later in his diary, a telephone call from Dr. Hanstengel. The Reichstag is on fire. I am sure he is telling a tall tale and decline even to mention it to the Führer. But the diners at the Herrenklub were just around the corner from the Reichstag. Suddenly, Papen later wrote, we noticed a red glow through the windows and heard sounds of shouting in the street. One of the servants came hurrying up to me and whispered, the Reichstag is on fire, which I repeated to the president. He got up, and from the window we could see the dome of the Reichstag looking as though it were illuminated by searchlights. Every now and again a burst of flame and a swirl of smoke blurred the outline. The vice-chancellor packed the aged president home in his own car and hurried off to the burning building. In the meantime, Goebbels, according to his account, had had second thoughts about Putzi Hamstengel's tall tale, had made some telephone calls and learned that the Reichstag was in flames. Within a few seconds he and his Führer were racing at 60 miles an hour down the Charlottenburger Chaussee toward the scene of the crime. That it was a crime, a communist crime, they proclaimed at once on arrival at the fire. Goering, sweating and puffing and quite beside himself with excitement, was already there ahead of them, declaiming to heaven, as Papen later recalled, that this is a communist crime against the new government. To the new Gestapo chief, Rudolf Diels, Goering shouted, this is the beginning of the communist revolution. We must not wait a minute. We will show no mercy. Every communist official must be shot where he is found. Every communist deputy must this very night be strung up. The whole truth about the Reichstag fire will probably never be known. Nearly all those who knew it are now dead, most of them slain by Hitler in the months that followed. Even at Nuremberg, the mystery could not be entirely unraveled, though there is enough evidence to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that it was the Nazis who planned the arson and carried it out for their own political ends. From Goering's Reichstag President's Palace, an underground passage, built to carry the central heating system, ran to the Reichstag building. Through this tunnel, Karl Ernst, a former hotel bellhop who had become the Berlin SA leader, led a small detachment of stormtroopers on the night of February 27th to the Reichstag, where they scattered gasoline and self-igniting chemicals, and then made their way quickly back to the palace the way they had come. At the same time, a half-witted Dutch communist with a passion for arson, Marinus van der Lubbe, had made his way into the huge, darkened, and to him unfamiliar building, and set some small fires of his own. This feeble-minded pyromaniac was a godsend to the Nazis. He had been picked up by the SA a few days before after having been overheard in a bar boasting that he had attempted to set fire to several public buildings, and that he was going to try the Reichstag next. The coincidence that the Nazis had found a demented communist arsonist who was out to do exactly what they themselves had determined to do seems incredible, but is nevertheless supported by the evidence. The idea for the fire almost certainly originated with Goebbels and Goering. Hans Gesavius, an official in the Prussian Ministry of the Interior at the time, testified at Nuremberg that it was Goebbels who first thought of setting the Reichstag on fire. And Rudolf Diels, the Gestapo chief, added in an affidavit that Goering knew exactly how the fire was to be started, and had ordered him to prepare, prior to the fire, a list of people who were to be arrested immediately after it. General Franz Halder, chief of the German General Staff during the early part of World War II, recalled at Nuremberg how on one occasion Goering had boasted of his deed. At a luncheon on the birthday of the Führer in 1942, the conversation turned to the topic of the Reichstag building and its artistic value. I heard with my own ears when Göring interrupted the conversation and shouted, "The only one who really knows about the Reichstag is I, because I set it on fire." With that, he slapped his thigh with the flat of his hand. Both in his interrogations and at his trial at Nuremberg, Göring denied to the last that he had had any part in setting fire to the Reichstag. Von der Lubbe, it seems clear, was a dupe of the Nazis. He was encouraged to try to set the Reichstag on fire, but the main job was to be done, without his knowledge, of course, by the stormtroopers. Indeed, it was established at the subsequent trial at Leipzig that the Dutch half-wit did not possess the means to set so vast a building on fire so quickly. 2.5 minutes after he entered, the great central hall was fiercely burning. He had only his shirt for tinder. The main fires, according to the testimony of experts at the trial, had been set with considerable quantities of chemicals and gasoline. It was obvious that one man could not have carried them into the building, nor would it have been possible for him to start so many fires in so many scattered places in so short a time. Von der Lubbe was arrested on the spot, and Göring, as he afterward told the court, wanted to hang him at once. The next day, Ernst Turgler, parliamentary leader of the communists, gave himself up to the police when he heard that Göring had implicated him, and a few days later, Georgi Dimitrov, a Bulgarian communist who later became prime minister of Bulgaria, and two other Bulgarian communists, Popov and Taneyev, were apprehended by the police. Their subsequent trial before the Supreme Court at Leipzig turned into something of a fiasco for the Nazis, and especially for Göring, whom Dimitrov, acting as his own lawyer, easily provoked into making a fool of himself in a series of stinging cross-examinations. At one point, according to the court record, Göring screamed at the Bulgarian, "Out with you, you scoundrel!" Judge to the police officer, "Take him away." Dimitrov, being led away by the police, "Are you afraid of my questions, Herr Minister President?" Göring, "You wait until we get you outside this court, you scoundrel." Torgler and the three Bulgarians were acquitted, though the German communist leader was immediately taken into protective custody, where he remained until his death during the Second War. Von der Lubbe was found guilty and decapitated. The trial, despite the subserviency of the court to the Nazi authorities, cast a great deal of suspicion on Göring and the Nazis, but it came too late to have any practical effect, for Hitler had lost no time in exploiting the Reichstag fire to the limit. On the day following the fire, February 28th, he prevailed on President Hindenburg to sign a decree for the protection of the people and the state, suspending the 7 sections of the Constitution which guaranteed individual and civil liberties. Described as a defensive measure against communist acts of violence endangering the state, the decree laid down that restrictions on personal liberty, on the right of free expression of opinion, including freedom of the press, on the rights of assembly and association, and violations of the privacy of postal, telegraphic, and telephonic communications, and warrants for house searchers, orders for confiscations, as well as restrictions on property, are also permissible beyond the legal limits otherwise prescribed. In addition, the decree authorized the Reich government to take over complete power in the federal states when necessary and impose the death sentence for a number of crimes, including serious disturbances of the peace by armed persons. Thus, with one stroke, Hitler was able not only to legally gag his opponents and arrest them at his will, but, by making the trumped-up communist threat official, as it were, to throw millions of the middle class and the peasantry into a frenzy of fear that unless they voted for National Socialism at the elections a week hence, the Bolsheviks might take over. Some 4,000 communist officials and a great many social democrat and liberal leaders were arrested, including members of the Reichstag, who, according to the law, were immune from arrest. This was the first experience Germans had had with Nazi terror backed up by the government. Truckloads of stormtroopers roared through the streets all over Germany, breaking into homes, rounding up victims and carting them off to SA barracks, where they were tortured and beaten. The communist press and political meetings were suppressed. The Social Democrat newspapers and many liberal journals were suspended, and the meetings of the Democratic parties either banned or broken up. Only the Nazis and their nationalist allies were permitted to campaign unmolested. With all the resources of the national and Prussian governments at their disposal, and with plenty of money from big business in their coffers, The Nazis carried on an election propaganda such as Germany had never seen before. For the first time, the state-run radio carried the voices of Hitler, Goering, and Goebbels to every corner of the land. The streets, bedecked with swastika flags, echoed to the tramp of the stormtroopers. There were mass rallies, torchlight parades, the din of loudspeakers in the squares. The billboards were plastered with flamboyant Nazi posters, and at night bonfires lit up the hills. The electorate was in turn cajoled with promises of a German paradise, intimidated by the brown terror in the streets and frightened by revelations about the communist revolution. The day after the Reichstag fire, the Prussian government issued a long statement declaring that it had found communist documents proving government buildings, museums, mansions, and essential plants were to be burned down. Women and children were to be sent in front of terrorist groups. The burning of the Reichstag was to be the signal for a bloody insurrection and civil war. It has been ascertained that today was to have seen throughout Germany terrorist acts against individual persons, against private property, and against the life and limb of the peaceful population, and also the beginning of general civil war. Publication of the documents proving the communist conspiracy was promised, but never made. The fact, however, that the Prussian government itself vouched for their authenticity impressed many Germans. The waverers were also impressed, perhaps, by Goering's threats. At Frankfurt on March 3rd, on the eve of the elections, he shouted, "Fellow Germans, my measures will not be crippled by any judicial thinking. I don't have to worry about justice. My mission is only to destroy and exterminate, nothing more. Certainly I shall use the power of the state and the police to the utmost, my dear communists, so don't draw any false conclusions. But the struggle to the death in which my fist will grasp your necks, I shall lead with those down there, the brown shirts." Almost unheard was the voice of former Chancellor Brüning, who also spoke out that day, proclaiming that his center party would resist any overthrow of the Constitution, demanding an investigation of the suspicious Reichstag fire, and calling on President Hindenburg to protect the oppressed against their oppressors. Vain appeal. The aged president kept his silence. It was now time for the people, in their convulsion, to speak. On March 5, 1933, the day of the last democratic elections they were to know during Hitler's life, they spoke with their ballots. Despite all the terror and intimidation, the majority of them rejected Hitler. The Nazis led the polling with 17,277,180 votes, an increase of some 5.5 million, but it comprised only 44% of the total vote. A clear majority still eluded Hitler. All the persecution and suppression of the previous weeks did not prevent the Center Party from actually increasing its vote, from 4,230,600 to 4,424,900. With its ally, the Catholic Bavarian People's Party, it obtained a total of 5.5 million votes. Even the Social Democrats held their position as the second largest party, polling 7,181,629 votes, a drop of only 70,000. The Communists lost 1 million supporters but still polled 4,848,058 votes. The Nationalists, led by Papen and Hugenberg, were bitterly disappointed with their own showing, a vote of 3,136,760, a mere 8% of the votes cast, and a gain of less than 200,000. Still, the Nationalists' 52 seats, added to the 288 of the Nazis, gave the government a majority of 16 in the Reichstag. This was enough, perhaps, to carry on the day-to-day business of government, but it was far short of the two-thirds majority which Hitler needed to carry out a new bold plan to establish his dictatorship by consent of Parliament. Gleichschaltung, the coordination of the Reich. The plan was deceptively simple and had the advantage of cloaking the seizure of absolute power in legality. The Reichstag would be asked to pass an enabling act, conferring on Hitler's cabinet exclusive legislative powers for 4 years. Put even more simply, the German parliament would be requested to turn over its constitutional functions to Hitler and take a long vacation. But since this necessitated a change in the constitution, a two-thirds majority was needed to approve it. How to obtain that majority was the main order of business at a cabinet meeting on March 15, 1933, the minutes of which were produced at Nuremberg. Part of the problem would be solved by the absence of the 81 communist members of the Reichstag. Goering felt sure that the rest of the problem could be easily disposed of by refusing admittance to a few social democrats. Hitler was in a breezy, confident mood. After all, by the decree of February 28th, which he had induced Hindenburg to sign the day after the Reichstag fire, he could arrest as many opposition deputies as was necessary to assure his two-thirds majority. There was some question about the Catholic Center, which was demanding guarantees, but the Chancellor was certain that this party would go along with him. Hugenberg, the nationalist leader, who had no desire to put all the power in Hitler's hands, demanded that the president be authorized to participate in preparing laws decreed by the cabinet under the Enabling Act. Dr. Meissner, the state secretary in the presidential chancellery, who had already committed his future to the Nazis, replied that the collaboration of the Reich president would not be necessary. He was quick to realize that Hitler had no wish to be tied down by the stubborn old president as the Republican chancellors had been. But Hitler wished, at this stage, to make a grandiose gesture to the aged field marshal and to the army and the nationalist conservatives as well, and in so doing link his rowdy revolutionary regime with Hindenburg's venerable name and with all the past military glories of Prussia. To accomplish this, he and Goebbels, who on March 13th became Minister of Propaganda, conceived a masterstroke. Hitler would open the new Reichstag, which he was about to destroy, in the garrison church at Potsdam, the great shrine of Prussianism, which aroused in so many Germans memories of imperial glories and grandeur. For here lay buried the bones of Frederick the Great, here the Hohenzollern kings had worshipped, here Hindenburg had first come in 1866 on a pilgrimage when he returned as a young guards officer from the Austro-Prussian War, a war which had given Germany its first unification. The date chosen for the ceremonial opening of the first Reichstag of the Third Reich, March 21st, was significant too, for it fell on the anniversary of the day on which Bismarck had opened the first Reichstag of the Second Reich in 1871. As the old field marshals, generals, and admirals from imperial times gathered in their resplendent uniforms in the garrison church, led by the former Crown Prince and Field Marshal von Mackensen in the imposing dress and headgear of the Death's Head Hussars, the shades of Frederick the Great and the Iron Chancellor hovered over the assembly. Hindenburg was visibly moved, and at one point in the ceremony Goebbels, who was staging the performance and directing the broadcasting of it to the nation, observed, and noted in his diary, that the old field marshal had tears in his eyes. Flanked by Hitler, who appeared ill at ease in his formal cutaway morning coat, the president, attired in field-gray uniform with the grand cordon of the Black Eagle, and carrying a spiked helmet in one hand and his marshal's baton in the other, had marched slowly down the aisle, paused to salute the empty seat of Kaiser Wilhelm II in the Imperial Gallery, and then in front of the altar had read a brief speech giving his blessings to the new Hitler government. May the old spirit of this celebrated shrine permeate the generation of today. May it liberate us from selfishness and party strife, and bring us together in national self-consciousness to bless a proud and free Germany, united in herself. Hitler's reply was shrewdly designed to play on the sympathies and enlist the confidence of the old order so glitteringly represented. Neither the Kaiser nor the government nor the nation wanted the war. It was only the collapse of the nation which compelled a weakened race to take upon itself, against its most sacred convictions, the guilt for this war. And then, turning to Hindenburg, who sat stiffly in his chair a few feet in front of him, by a unique upheaval in the last few weeks, our national honor has been restored, and thanks to your understanding, Herr Generalfeldmarschall, the union between the symbols of the old greatness and the new strength has been celebrated. We pay you homage. A protective providence places you over the new forces of our nation. Hitler, with a show of deep humility toward the president he intended to rob of his political power before the week was up, stepped down, bowed low to Hindenburg, and gripped his hand. There, in the flashing lights of camera bulbs and amid the clicking of movie cameras, which Goebbels had placed along with microphones at strategic spots, was recorded for the nation and the world to see, and to hear described, the solemn hand clasp of the German field marshal and the Austrian corporal, uniting the new Germany with the old. After the dazzling pledge made by Hitler at Potsdam, the French ambassador who was present at the scene later wrote, how could such men, Hindenburg and his friends, the Junkers and monarchist barons, Hugenberg and his German nationalists, the officers of the Reichswehr, how could they fail to dismiss the apprehension with which they had begun to view the excesses and abuses of his party? Could they now hesitate to grant him their entire confidence, to meet all his requests, to concede the full powers he claimed? The answer was given 2 days later, on March 23rd, in the Kroll Opera House in Berlin, where the Reichstag convened. Before the house was the so-called Enabling Act, the Law for Removing the Distress of People and Reich, Gesetz zur Beebung der Not von Volk und Reich, as it was officially called. Its 5 brief paragraphs took the power of legislation, including control of the Reich budget, approval of treaties with foreign states, and the initiating of constitutional amendments, away from Parliament and handed it over to the Reich cabinet for a period of 4 years. Moreover, the act stipulated that the laws enacted by the cabinet were to be drafted by the Chancellor and might deviate from the Constitution. No laws were to affect the position of the Reichstag, surely the cruelest joke of all, and the powers of the president remained undisturbed. Hitler reiterated these last 2 points in a speech of unexpected restraint to the deputies assembled in the ornate opera house, which had long specialized in the lighter operatic works and whose aisles were now lined with brown-shirted stormtroopers, whose scarred, bully faces indicated that no nonsense would be tolerated from the representatives of the people. The government, Hitler promised, will make use of these powers only insofar as they are essential for carrying out vitally necessary measures. Neither the existence of the Reichstag nor that of the Reichsrat is menaced. The position and rights of the president remain unaltered. The separate existence of the federal states will not be done away with. The rights of the churches will not be diminished, and their relationship to the state will not be modified. The number of cases in which an internal necessity exists for having recourse to such a law is in itself a limited one. The fiery Nazi leader sounded quite moderate and almost modest. It was too early in the life of the Third Reich for even the opposition members to know full well the value of Hitler's promises. Yet one of them, Otto Wels, leader of the Social Democrats, a dozen of whose deputies had been detained by the police, rose, amid the roar of the stormtroopers outside yelling, "Full powers or else!" to defy the would-be dictator. Speaking quietly and with great dignity, Wels declared that the government might strip the socialists of their power, but it could never strip them of their honor. "We German Social Democrats pledge ourselves solemnly in this historic hour to the principles of humanity and justice, of freedom and socialism. No enabling act can give you the power to destroy ideas which are eternal and indestructible." Furious, Hitler jumped to his feet, and now the assembly received a real taste of the man. "You come late, but yet you come," he shouted. "You are no longer needed. The star of Germany will rise and yours will sink. Your death knell has sounded. I do not want your votes. Germany will be free, but not through you." Stormy applause. The Social Democrats, who bore a heavy responsibility for the weakening of the Republic, would at least stick to their principles and go down, this one time, defiantly. But not the Center Party, which once had successfully defied the Iron Chancellor in the Kutterkampf. Monsignor Kass, the party leader, had demanded a written promise from Hitler that he would respect the president's power of veto. But though promised before the voting, it was never given. Nevertheless, the center leader rose to announce that his party would vote for the bill. Brüning remained silent. The vote was soon taken, 441 for and 84 all Social Democrats against. The Nazi deputies sprang to their feet shouting and stamping deliriously, and then, joined by the stormtroopers, burst into the Horst Wessel song, which soon would take its place alongside Deutschland über alles as one of the 2 national anthems. "Raise high the flags, stand rank on rank together, stormtroopers march with steady, quiet tread." Thus was parliamentary democracy finally interred in Germany. Except for the arrests of the communists and some of the Social Democratic deputies, it was all done quite legally, though accompanied by terror. Parliament had turned over its constitutional authority to Hitler and thereby committed suicide, though its body lingered on in an embalmed state to the very end of the Third Reich, serving infrequently as a sounding board for some of Hitler's thunderous pronunciamentos, its members henceforth hand-picked by the Nazi Party. For there were to be no more real elections. It was this enabling act alone which formed the legal basis for Hitler's dictatorship. From March 23, 1933 on, Hitler was the dictator of the Reich, freed of any restraint by Parliament or, for all practical purposes, by the weary old president. To be sure, much remained to be done to bring the entire nation and all its institutions completely under the Nazi heel, though, as we shall see, this also was accomplished with breathless speed and with crudeness, trickery, and brutality. The street gangs, in the words of Alan Bullock, had seized control of the resources of a great modern state. The gutter had come to power. But, as Hitler never ceased to boast, legally, by an overwhelming vote of Parliament, the Germans had no one to blame but themselves. One by one, Germany's most powerful institutions now began to surrender to Hitler and to pass, quietly, unprotestingly, out of existence. The states, which had stubbornly maintained their separate powers throughout German history, were the first to fall. On the evening of March 9th, 2 weeks before the passage of the Enabling Act, General von Epp, on orders from Hitler and Frick and with the help of a few stormtroopers, turned out the government of Bavaria and set up a Nazi regime. Within a week, Reich commissars were appointed to take over in the other states, with the exception of Prussia, where Goering was already firmly in the saddle. On March 31st, Hitler and Frick, using the Enabling Act for the first time, promulgated a law dissolving the diets of all states except Prussia and ordering them reconstituted on the basis of the votes cast in the last Reichstag election. Communist seats were not to be filled. But this solution lasted only a week. The Chancellor, working at feverish haste, issued a new law on April 7th, appointing Reich governors, Reichsstatthalter, in all the states, and empowering them to appoint and remove local governments, dissolve the diets, and appoint and dismiss state officials and judges. Each of the new governors was a Nazi, and they were required to carry out the general policy laid down by the Reich Chancellor. Thus, within a fortnight of receiving full powers from the Reichstag, Hitler had achieved what Bismarck, Wilhelm II, and the Weimar Republic had never dared to attempt. He had abolished the separate powers of the historic states and made them subject to the central authority of the Reich, which was in his hands. He had, for the first time in German history, really unified the Reich by destroying its age-old federal character. On January 30, 1934, the first anniversary of his becoming Chancellor, Hitler would formally complete the task by means of a law for the reconstruction of the Reich. Popular assemblies of the states were abolished, the sovereign powers of the states were transferred to the Reich, all state governments were placed under the Reich government, and the state governors put under the administration of the Reich Minister of the Interior. As this minister, Frick, explained it, the state governments from now on are merely administrative bodies of the Reich. The preamble to the law of January 30, 1934, proclaimed that it was promulgated with the unanimous vote of the Reichstag. This was true, for by this time all the political parties of Germany except the Nazis had been quickly eliminated. It cannot be said that they went down fighting. On May 19, 1933, the Social Democrats, those who were not in jail or in exile, voted in the Reichstag without a dissenting voice to approve Hitler's foreign policy. 9 days before, Goering's police had seized the party's buildings and newspapers and confiscated its property. Nevertheless, the socialists still tried to appease Hitler. They denounced their comrades abroad who were attacking the Führer. On June 19th, they elected a new party committee, but 3 days later Frick put an end to their attempts to compromise by dissolving the Social Democratic Party as subversive and inimical to the state. Paul Loba, the surviving leader, and several of his party members in the Reichstag were arrested. The communists, of course, had already been suppressed. This left the middle-class parties, but not for long. The Catholic Bavarian People's Party, whose government had been kicked out of office by the Nazi coup on March 9th, announced its own dissolution on July 4th, and its ally, the Center Party, which had defied Bismarck so strenuously and been a bulwark of the Republic, followed suit the next day, leaving Germany for the first time in the modern era without a Catholic political party, a fact which did not discourage the Vatican from signing a concordat with Hitler's government a fortnight later. Stresemann's old party, the People's Party, committed harakiri on the 4th of July. The Democrats, Staatspartei, had already done so a week before. And what of Hitler's partner in government, the German National Party, without whose support the former Austrian corporal could never have come legally to power? Despite its closeness to Hindenburg, the army, the Junkers, and big business, and the debt owed to it by Hitler, it went the way of all other parties, and with the same meekness. On June 21st, the police and the stormtroopers took over its offices throughout the country, and on June 29th, Hugenberg, the bristling party leader who had helped boost Hitler into the chancellery but 6 months before, resigned from the government, and his aides voluntarily dissolved the party. The Nazi Party alone remained, and on July 14th, a law decreed, "The National Socialist German Workers' Party constitutes the only political party in Germany. Whoever undertakes to maintain the organizational structure of another political party, or to form a new political party, will be punished with penal servitude up to 3 years, or with imprisonment of from 6 months to 3 years, if the deed is not subject to a greater penalty according to other regulations." The one-party totalitarian state had been achieved with scarcely a ripple of opposition or defiance, and within 4 months after the Reichstag had abdicated its democratic responsibilities. The free trade unions, which, as we have seen, once had crushed the fascist Kapp-Putsch by the simple means of declaring a general strike, were disposed of as easily as the political parties in the states, though not until an elaborate piece of trickery had been practiced on them. For half a century, May Day had been the traditional day of celebration for the German and European worker. To lull the workers and their leaders before it struck, the Nazi government proclaimed May Day 1933 as a national holiday, officially named it the Day of National Labor, and prepared to celebrate it as it had never been celebrated before. The trade union leaders were taken in by this surprising display of friendliness toward the working class by the Nazis, and enthusiastically cooperated with the government and the party in making the day a success. Labor leaders were flown to Berlin from all parts of Germany. Thousands of banners were unfurled, acclaiming the Nazi regime's solidarity with the worker. And out at Tempelhof Field, Goebbels prepared to stage the greatest mass demonstration Germany had ever seen. Before the massive rally, Hitler himself received the workers' delegates, declaring, "You will see how untrue and unjust is the statement that the revolution is directed against the German workers. On the contrary." Later, in his speech to more than 100,000 workers at the airfield, Hitler pronounced the motto, "Honor work and respect the worker," and promised that May Day would be celebrated in honor of German labor throughout the centuries. Late that night, Goebbels, after describing in his most purple prose the tremendous enthusiasm of the workers for this May Day celebration, which he had so brilliantly staged, added a curious sentence in his diary. "Tomorrow we shall occupy the trade union buildings. There will be little resistance." A document which came to light at Nuremberg shows that the Nazis had been planning for some time to destroy the trade unions. A secret order dated April 21st and signed by Dr. Ley contained detailed instructions for coordinating the unions on May 2nd. SA and SS troops were to carry out the occupation of trade union properties and to take into protective custody all union leaders. Union funds were to be seized. The Christian, Catholic, trade unions were not molested on May 2nd. Their end came on June 24th. This is what happened. On May 2nd, the trade union headquarters throughout the country were occupied, union funds confiscated, the unions dissolved, and the leaders arrested. Many were beaten and lodged in concentration camps. Theodor Leipart and Peter Grassmann, the chairman of the Trade Union Confederation, had openly pledged themselves to cooperate with the Nazi regime. No matter, they were arrested. "The Leiparts and Grassmanns," said Dr. Robert Ley, the alcoholic Cologne party boss who was assigned by Hitler to take over the unions and establish the German labor front, "may hypocritically declare their devotion to the Führer as much as they like, but it is better that they should be in prison." And that is where they were put. At first, though, both Hitler and Ley tried to assure the workers that their rights would be protected. Said Ley in his first proclamation, "Workers, your institutions are sacred to us National Socialists. I myself am a poor peasant's son and understand poverty. I know the exploitation of anonymous capitalism. Workers, I swear to you, we will not only keep everything that exists, we will build up the protection and the rights of the workers still further. Within 3 weeks, the hollowness of another Nazi promise was exposed, when Hitler decreed a law bringing an end to collective bargaining and providing that henceforth labor trustees, appointed by him, would regulate labor contracts and maintain labor peace. Since the decisions of the trustees were to be legally binding, the law, in effect, outlawed strikes. Lai promised to restore absolute leadership to the natural leader of a factory, that is, the employer. Only the employer can decide. Many employers have for years had to call for the master in the house. Now they are once again to be the master in the house. For the time being, business management was pleased. The generous contributions which so many employers had made to the National Socialist German Workers' Party were paying off. Yet for business to prosper, a certain stability of society is necessary. And all through the spring and early summer, law and order were crumbling in Germany as the frenzied brown-shirted gangs roamed the streets, arresting and beating up and sometimes murdering whomever they pleased, while the police looked on without lifting a nightstick. The terror in the streets was not the result of the breakdown of the state's authority, as it had been in the French Revolution, but on the contrary was carried out with the encouragement and often on the orders of the state, whose authority in Germany had never been greater or more concentrated. Judges were intimidated. They were afraid for their lives if they convicted and sentenced a stormtrooper, even for cold-blooded murder. Hitler was now the law, as Goering said, and as late as May and June 1933, the Führer was declaiming that the National Socialist Revolution has not yet run its course, and that it will be victoriously completed only if a new German people is educated. In Nazi parlance, educated meant intimidated, to a point where all would accept docilely the Nazi dictatorship and its barbarism. To Hitler, as he had publicly declared 1,000 times, the Jews were not Germans, and though he did not exterminate them at once, only a relative few, a few thousand, that is, were robbed, beaten, or murdered during the first months. He issued laws excluding them from public service, the universities, and the professions. And on April 1, 1933, he proclaimed a national boycott of Jewish shops. The businessmen, who had been so enthusiastic over the smashing of the troublesome labor unions, now found that left-wing Nazis, who really believed in the party's socialism, were trying to take over the employers' associations, destroy the big department stores, and nationalize industry. Thousands of ragged Nazi party officials descended on the business houses of those who had not supported Hitler, threatening to seize them in some cases, and in others demanding well-paying jobs in the management. Dr. Gottfried Feder, the economic crank, now insisted that the party program be carried out. Nationalization of big business, profit-sharing, and the abolition of unearned incomes and interest slavery. As if this were not enough to frighten the businessmen, Walter Daré, who had just been named Minister of Agriculture, threw the bankers into jitters by promising a big reduction in the capital debts of the farmers and a cut in the interest rate on what remained to 2%. Why not? Hitler was, by midsummer of 1933, the master of Germany. He could now carry out his program. Papen, for all his cunning, had been left high and dry, and all his calculations that he and Hugenberg and the other defenders of the old order, with their 8-3 majority in the cabinet against the Nazis, could control Hitler and indeed use him for their own conservative ends, had exploded in his face. He himself had been booted out of his post as Prime Minister of Prussia and replaced by Goering. Papen remained vice-chancellor in the Reich cabinet, but, as he ruefully admitted later, this position turned out to be anomalous. Hugenberg, the apostle of business and finance, was gone, his party dissolved. Goebbels, the third most important man in the Nazi party, had been brought into the cabinet on March 13th as Minister of Popular Enlightenment and Propaganda. Daré, regarded as a radical, as was Goebbels, was Minister of Agriculture. Dr. Hans Luther, the conservative president of the Reichsbank, the key post in the German economic system, was fired by Hitler and packed off to Washington as ambassador. Into his place on March 17, 1933, stepped the jaunty Dr. Schacht, the former head of the Reichsbank and devoted follower of Hitler, who had seen the truth and necessity of Nazism. No single man in all of Germany would be more helpful to Hitler in building up the economic strength of the Third Reich and in furthering its rearmament for the Second World War than Schacht, who later became also Minister of Economics and Plenipotentiary General for War Economy. It is true that shortly before the Second War began, he turned against his idol, eventually relinquished or was fired from all his offices, and even joined those who were conspiring to assassinate Hitler. But by then it was too late to stay the course of the Nazi leader to whom he had for so long given his loyalty and lent his prestige and his manifest talents. No Second Revolution. Hitler had conquered Germany with the greatest of ease, but a number of problems remained to be faced as summer came in 1933. There were at least five major ones: preventing a second revolution, settling the uneasy relations between the SA and the army, getting the country out of its economic morass and finding jobs for the 6 million unemployed, achieving equality of armaments for Germany at the disarmament conference in Geneva, and accelerating the Reich's secret rearming, which had begun during the last years of the Republic, and deciding who should succeed the ailing Hindenburg when he died. It was Röhm, the chief of the SA, who coined the phrase the Second Revolution and who insisted that it be carried through. He was joined by Goebbels, who in his diary of April 18, 1933, wrote, "Everyone among the people is talking of a second revolution which must come. That means that the first revolution is not at an end. Now we shall settle with the Reaktion. The revolution must nowhere come to a halt." The Nazis had destroyed the left, but the right remained. Big business and finance, the aristocracy, the Junker landlords, and the Prussian generals, who kept tight rein over the army. Röhm, Goebbels, and the other radicals in the movement wanted to liquidate them too. Röhm, whose stormtroopers now numbered some 2 million, 20 times as many as the troops in the army, sounded the warning in June. "One victory on the road of German revolution has been won. The SA and SS, who bear the great responsibility of having set the German revolution rolling, will not allow it to be betrayed at the halfway mark. If the Philistines believe that the national revolution has lasted too long, it is indeed high time that the national revolution should end and become a national socialist one. We shall continue our fight, with them or without them, and, if necessary, against them. We are the incorruptible guarantors of the fulfillment of the German revolution." And in August, he added in a speech, "There are still men in official positions today who have not the least idea of the spirit of the revolution. We shall ruthlessly get rid of them if they dare to put their reactionary ideas into practice." But Hitler had contrary thoughts. For him, the Nazi socialist slogans had been merely propaganda, means of winning over the masses on his way to power. Now that he had the power, he was uninterested in them. He needed time to consolidate his position and that of the country. For the moment, at least, the right, business, the army, the president, must be appeased. He did not intend to bankrupt Germany and thus risk the very existence of his regime. There must be no second revolution. This he made plain to the SA and SS leaders themselves in a speech to them on July 1st. "What was needed now in Germany," he said, "was order. I will suppress every attempt to disturb the existing order as ruthlessly as I will deal with the so-called Second Revolution, which would lead only to chaos." He repeated the warning to the Nazi state governors gathered in the Chancellery on July 6th. "The revolution is not a permanent state of affairs, and it must not be allowed to develop into such a state. The stream of revolution released must be guided into the safe channel of evolution. We must therefore not dismiss a businessman if he is a good businessman, even if he is not yet a National Socialist, and especially not if the National Socialist who is to take his place knows nothing about business. In business, ability must be the only standard. History will not judge us according to whether we have removed and imprisoned the largest number of economists, but according to whether we have succeeded in providing work. The ideas of the program do not oblige us to act like fools and upset everything, but to realize our trains of thought wisely and carefully. In the long run, our political power will be all the more secure, the more we succeed in underpinning it economically. The state governors must therefore see to it that no party organizations assume the functions of government, dismiss individuals and make appointments to offices, to do which the Reich government, and in regard to business, the Reich Minister of Economics, is competent. No more authoritative statement was ever made that the Nazi Revolution was political, not economic. To back up his words, Hitler dismissed a number of Nazi radicals who had tried to seize control of the employers' associations. He restored Krupp von Bohlen and Fritz Thyssen to their positions of leadership in them, dissolved the Combat League of Middle-Class Tradespeople, which had annoyed the big department stores, and in place of Hugenberg named Dr. Carl Schmitt as Minister of Economics. Schmitt was the most orthodox of businessmen, Director General of Allianz, Germany's largest insurance company, and he lost no time in putting an end to the schemes of the National Socialists who had been naive enough to take their party program seriously. The disillusion among the rank-and-file Nazis, especially among the SA stormtroopers who formed the large core of Hitler's mass movement, was great. Most of them had belonged to the ragged army of the dispossessed and the unsatisfied. They were anti-capitalist through experience, and they believed that the revolution which they had fought by brawling in the streets would bring them loot and good jobs, either in business or in the government. Now their hopes, after the heady excesses of the spring, were dashed. The old gang, whether they were party members or not, were to keep the jobs and to keep control of jobs. But this development was not the only reason for unrest in the SA. The old quarrel between Hitler and Röhm about the position and purpose of the SA cropped up again. From the earliest days of the Nazi movement, Hitler had insisted that the stormtroopers were to be a political and not a military force. They were to furnish the physical violence, the terror, by which the party could bludgeon its way to political power. To Röhm, the SA had been not only the backbone of the Nazi revolution, but the nucleus of the future revolutionary army, which would be for Hitler what the French conscript armies were to Napoleon after the French Revolution. It was time to sweep away the reactionary Prussian generals, those old clods, as he contemptuously called them, and form a revolutionary fighting force, a people's army led by himself and his tough aides who had conquered the streets of Germany. Nothing could be further from Hitler's thoughts. He realized more clearly than Röhm or any other Nazi that he could not have come to power without the support or at least the toleration of the army generals, and that, for the time being at least, his very survival at the helm depended in part on their continued backing, since they still retained the physical power to remove him if they were so minded. Also, Hitler foresaw that the army's loyalty to him personally would be needed at that crucial moment, which could not be far off, when the 86-year-old Hindenburg, the commander-in-chief, would pass on. Furthermore, the Nazi leader was certain that only the officer corps, with all its martial traditions and abilities, could achieve his goal of building up in a short space of time a strong, disciplined armed force. The SA was but a mob, good enough for street fighting but of little worth as a modern army. Moreover, its purpose had now been served, and from now on it must be eased tactfully out of the picture. The views of Hitler and Röhm were irreconcilable, and from the summer of 1933 to June 30th of the following year, a struggle literally to the death was to be fought between these two veterans of the Nazi movement, who were also close friends. Ernst Röhm was the only man whom Hitler addressed by the familiar personal pronoun, Du. Röhm expressed the deep sense of frustration in the ranks of the stormtroopers in a speech to 15,000 SA officers in the Sportpalast in Berlin on November 5, 1933. "One often hears that the SA had lost any reason for existence," he said, warning that it had not. But Hitler was adamant. "The relation of the SA to the army," he had warned at Bad Godesberg on August 19th, "must be the same as that of the political leadership." And on September 23rd at Nuremberg, he spoke out even more clearly. "On this day we should particularly remember the part played by our army, for we all know well that if, in the days of our revolution, the army had not stood on our side, then we should not be standing here today. We can assure the army that we shall never forget this, that we see in them the bearers of the tradition of our glorious old army, and that with all our heart and all our powers we will support the spirit of this army." Sometime before this, Hitler had secretly given the armed forces assurances which had brought many of the higher officers to his side. On February 2, 1933, 3 days after assuming office, he had made a 2-hour address to the top generals and admirals at the home of General von Hammerstein, the army commander-in-chief. Admiral Erich Raeder revealed at Nuremberg the tenor of this first meeting of the Nazi chancellor with the officer corps. Hitler, he said, freed the military elite from its fears that the armed services might be called upon to take part in a civil war, and promised that the army and navy could now devote themselves unhindered to the main task of quickly rearming the new Germany. Admiral Raeder admitted that he was highly pleased at the prospect of a new navy, and General von Blomberg, whose hasty assumption of the office of Minister of Defense on January 30, 1933, had stamped out any temptation on the part of the army to revolt against Hitler's becoming chancellor, declared later in his unpublished memoirs that the Führer opened up a field of activities holding great possibilities for the future. Further to augment the enthusiasm of the military leaders, Hitler created, as early as April 4th, the Reich Defense Council to spur a new and secret rearmament program. 3 months later, on July 20th, the Chancellor promulgated a new army law, abolishing the jurisdiction of the civil courts over the military, and doing away with the elected representation of the rank and file, thus restoring to the officer corps its ancient military prerogatives. A good many generals and admirals began to see the Nazi revolution in a different and more favorable light. As a sop to Röhm, Hitler named him, along with Rudolf Hess, the deputy leader of the party, a member of the cabinet on December 1st, and on New Year's Day 1934 addressed to the SA chief a warm and friendly letter. While reiterating that the army has to guarantee the protection of the nation against the world beyond our frontiers, he acknowledged that the task of the SA is to secure the victory of the National Socialist Revolution and the existence of the National Socialist State, and that the success of the SA had been primarily due to Röhm. The letter concluded, "At the close of the year of the National Socialist Revolution, therefore, I feel compelled to thank you, my dear Ernst Röhm, for the imperishable services which you have rendered to the National Socialist Movement and the German people, and to assure you how very grateful I am to fate that I am able to call such men as you my friends and fellow combatants. In true friendship and grateful regard, your Adolf Hitler." The letter, employing the familiar Du, was published in the chief Nazi daily paper, the Völkischer Beobachter, on January 2, 1934. And did much to ease for the moment the feelings of resentment in the SA. In the atmosphere of good feeling that prevailed over the Christmas and New Year holidays, the rivalry between the SA and the army, and the clamor of the radical Nazis for the Second Revolution, was temporarily stilled.